You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any unions involved. And welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by Sheet Metal Workers Local 2 and United Steelworkers District 11. SMART, Sheet Metal Workers Local 2, represents 1,200 workers in western Missouri and eastern Kansas. We start with the sheet metal and make nearly everything out of it for industry, heating and air conditioning, architectural roofs and siding, kitchens, and even works of art. And United Steelworkers District 11, representing 35,000 members in the Midwest. Protecting worker rights and organizing the unorganized, we support union-made products. And the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI thank our underwriters for their support. On tonight's show, after all the alarm about votes lost in the mail, we're going to ask Andy Tuttle, Kansas State President of the Union of Letter Carriers, if all the votes got delivered and what's the next crisis for the U.S. Postal Service. And then, it's been widely reported that women workers are big losers in the COVID catastrophe. We'll find out how bad it is and how hard it'll be to recapture lost jobs and careers from Nicole Bateman of the Brookings Institution. In the news, APWU shifts its sights to Biden for a bailout, and St. Luke's Hospital joins the $15 an hour club. Our feature at the end of the show is Know Your Rights with Angie Williams. She'll explain why Texas and other states couldn't change the election results. And now for the news.
And this is the news from our side, December 17th, 2020. It looks like the American postal workers have given up on any bailout for Mitch McConnell and are setting their sights on Joe Biden. The new stimulus will evidently just give a paltry $300 to people and no bailout for the post office or state and local government. So the APWU today launched a campaign targeting President-elect Biden with a petition. It features APWU retiree Byron Denton, who is 92 years old.
We old-timers often tell how hard we had it. When I was a postal worker, we had some tough times, but we never had a year like this. Today's postal workers delivered for you. With billions of pieces of vital mail, medicine and packages, 65 million ballots, and now holiday gifts, all during a pandemic, they've made America proud and deserve all of our support this season and all the seasons to come.
If you want to stand with postal workers and a public U.S. Postal Service, you can sign the petition to at apwu.org/petition.
And this comes from the Missouri Independent. In one of the most bizarre bills to be pre-filed for the 2021 legislative session in Missouri, newly minted State Senator Rick Bratton, a former House Republican, from Harrisonville has introduced a bill to bar lawsuits against drivers for injuries to a person who is blocking traffic in a public right-of-way while participating in a protest or demonstration, unless the driver's action constitutes gross negligence. Could this be a license to mow down demonstrators who you don't like and just say, oops, I lost control? Presumably, Bratton is reacting to a summer marked by protests against police violence around the country. The bill targets demonstrations in numerous ways. It would also yank benefits from public employees convicted of unlawful assembly or rioting, withhold state funds from local governments who cut the police budgets too much, and impose a prison term of 5 to 15 years for vandalizing a monument on public property. Another proposal from State Representative Adam Schnelting, a Republican from St. Charles, also wants to shield drivers who injure or kill demonstrators with their cars. His proposal, which covers both civil and criminal liability, would apply to people fleeing an unlawful or riotous assemblage if the person reasonably believes he or she or an occupant of the motor vehicles is in danger. Frank Bowman, a professor of law at the University of Missouri who specializes in criminal justice, called the bills troubling. He said, "Let's assume I'm spooked by the Black Lives Matter demonstrators or the Proud Boys on the corner and I speed away. Apparently, there's no limitation in how prudent I have to be. This is basically open season on any pedestrian who happens to be within one block, two blocks, three blocks."
Steve Vockrott reported this week in the Kansas City Star that USCIS, that's U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, told local members of Congress last week that it plans to hire back about 250 workers in Lee's Summit months after it enacted deep job cuts in the Kansas City region. Congress was able to provide funding to supplement increases in workload to allow the National Benefits Center, a branch of USCIS, that processes immigration applications, to start hiring again in Lee's Summit. It partially restores staffing at National Benefits Center after some 800 jobs were eliminated during the summer as USCIS grappled with severe revenue declines. USCIS usually doesn't receive money directly from Congress. It generates its own revenue through immigration application fees. The 800 jobs were contract positions provided by PAE, a private contractor that provides staffing for the National Benefits Center. It was one of the largest mass layoffs in the Kansas City region as the coronavirus pandemic plunged the national economy into a recession. USCIS said that this summer, when imposing job cuts, that immigration activity slowed during the pandemic, leading to losses in agency revenue.
On December 2nd, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission District Office in St. Louis announced that Edgewood Manor OPCO LLC, a former owner of the Edgewood Manor Skilled Nursing Facility in Raytown, will pay $40,000 and furnish other relief to settle a sex pay discrimination lawsuit. The suit was filed by the EEOC. 12 female licensed practical nurses, or LPNs, who worked at the facility from 2017 to 2020 were paid less than male LPNs doing the same job. Specifically, the company paid female LPNs from $20 to $26.50 per hour based on years of experience, while paying male LPNs with the same or less experience $25 to $27 an hour. Paying women less than men for doing a job with the same required skill, effort, responsibility, and under the same working conditions violates the Equal Pay Act of 1963, as well as Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. The EEOC filed suit after first trying to negotiate a settlement with Edgewood Manor OPCO. The EEOC originally sued on behalf of only one female LPN, but during litigation discovered 11 other women who were also paid less than men.
Finally, the Labor Beacon tells us that St. Luke's Health System has joined the $15 an hour club. In late November, St. Luke's announced it will pay a permanent minimum of $15 an hour to show gratitude and support frontline staff during the pandemic. Unfortunately, other area hospitals aren't so grateful. Laura Barrett of SEIU Healthcare said, "Other healthcare facilities need to pay attention to what St. Luke's is doing and match them because workers right now are just working their hearts out." Barrett represents about 900 workers at Research and Menora Hospitals in the HCA system. The union demanded a $15 minimum recently, but HCA said no to that and hazard pay. The news tonight was read by Judy Ansel, and I'm Jen Zaman.
Good evening, and welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. I'm your host, Michael Savoie. Our show tonight was planned to address the fear and apprehension that seemed to be deliberately created around the pre-election mail and absentee balloting. My guest tonight is Andy Tuttle, president of the Kansas State Letter Carriers Association. Good evening, Andy. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Thank you for joining us.
Good evening, and thank you for having me, Michael.
Very good. Andy, you know, there's certainly seems to be a lot of effort made to deter or undermine mail balloting in our recent national election. The removal of high-speed sorting machines, the elimination of overtime, the closing of postal substations, et cetera, et cetera. Why, one of our media outlets even showed the mailbox graveyard, literally thousands of retired mailboxes in their final resting place. Yet when all was said and done, it seems like it didn't have a measurable impact. What can you tell us about that?
Well, I think that a lot of the information that got out about changes within the Postal Service were based on an internal memo that was probably some DM somewhere sort of overreacting to a teleconference. Overtime was not eliminated. There were some changes within the transportation network. Collection boxes were taken out, but you know, I've been a letter carrier for 23 years. They've been taking out collection boxes for a long time. So certainly the appearance and the timing was not good at all. But it probably wasn't a part of an organized campaign. Mm-hmm. In my take, you know, I'm a letter carrier in one office. I'm sure that the clerks and the APWU probably have a very different take on this because that was their work. Mm-hmm. Other than the collection boxes, which is letter carrier work. Yeah. You know, the election went off without a hitch as far as the Postal Service was concerned. So as far as that goes, you know, people have been voting more and more by mail for, you know, many years now. We've gotten much better at the process, both in the Postal Service and in the local election offices. Mm-hmm. And so I know there was some concern that I saw of, oh, can the post office handle an election by mail? Well, you know, we handle 470 million pieces of mail every day. So if 100 million people voted by mail, that's a drop in the bucket. And I think that the Postal Service performed our role in the election quite admirably.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's from my perspective, it seemed like there was a lot of misinformation being circulated, and you couldn't tell what was the truth and what was the what's the imaginary word for facts anymore, you know. But at any rate,
alternative facts.
The alternatives, right. One thing is for sure, Andy, that the U.S. Postal Service has been under the hammer for at least 10 years. Could you tell us about that 2006 pre-funding law?
And yeah. Go ahead. We just passed the 14th anniversary of George W. Bush signing the Postal Accountability and Enhancement Act of 2006 into law. And, you know, the lasting impact that that has had is it's basically forced the Postal Service to be broke for the last 14 years. Because what it purported to do was to pre-fund future retirees' health care benefits for a period many decades in advance, so probably 75 years in advance, and to do so in a 10-year period. The Postal Service is a very labor-intensive organization. You know, labor costs represent a huge amount of the postal, you know, the postal budget every year, because we are delivering to everywhere. We are, you know, handling pieces of mail by hand delivering hundreds of billions of pieces of mail every year. So it's very labor intensive. We go to all communities. So the profit margin is pretty small there to begin with. But through most of the 90s and the 2000s, the early 2000s, we were making a pretty healthy profit for those years. So, and there was getting ready to be some people who were going to retire. So in its wisdom, Congress decided that we need to pre-fund 75 years worth of future retiree health care benefits in a 10-year period. So basically we had a $5.5 billion to $6 billion payment that came right off the top every year. And so we paid that for probably the first 5 or 6 years. And then we ran out of money, and we had exhausted our borrowing authority with the Fed. So we just quit making the payment. But every year that loss is reporting, you know. So, you know, right off the top, even though we didn't make that payment for a number of years, you know, that was a reported loss. So you might hear that the Postal Service, well, you know, in the last few years we've lost more, but say in, you know, 2017-18, you might have read that the post office lost, you know, $4 or $5 billion. We actually made a profit. We just had to report a loss. Mm-hmm. And I think that one of the sort of lasting impacts of that, and it's been going on for a long time now, you know, we had shortly after that, followed by the Great Recession. We lost a lot of mail volume then, traditional mail volume, paper mail volume. And so, you know, and we didn't have any money, and we were making these huge payments. So the response of the Postal Service was, well, we need to shut down. We need to have an austerity program. We need to shut down the operation. We need to close plants. We need to close offices. We need to close stations within cities. And they did that through the early 2010s. And they were able to get away with it because, you know, the business of the Postal Service really was not doing very well.
Yeah.
But well, then something happened on the way to the graveyard. The internet that was supposed to have killed the Postal Service became a source of revenue because people started to buy stuff online. And with the pandemic, we've really seen the paper mail volume go down yet again, because there's less advertising going on. But parcel volume, and you know, we hope that some of that comes back, we'll see. But the parcel volume has just exploded. So we are more and more becoming a parcel delivery company, which is something I know you're quite familiar with, Michael.
Yeah. Well, being an ex-UPSer, well, I've watched that happen too. So essentially, Andy, the 2006 pre-funding then allowed for the overpayment of retirement benefits, which has certainly put you in a hole, in a sense, put you in the red ink, and justified the assertion that you're losing money. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, absolutely. And then that was used to justify downsizing the operation and this idea that the post office had to shrink to survive, mm-hmm. as opposed to maybe having some creative thinking about mm-hmm. new sources of revenue, mm-hmm. which, you know, have come through the parcel business.
Yeah.
And so, you know, and one of the other things about that is that, you know, without getting into too much detail, postal facilities are not great. We drive trucks that were built between 1987 and 1994. There have been, in about the last 5 years, there's been about 400 of those vehicles that have caught fire. Now, if that were a consumer vehicle on the street, that vehicle would have been recalled. But, you know, it's a postal long life vehicle, so they can't be recalled, and they do keep catching on fire. And so that's been a concern. And that's one of the things that happens when you have no money is you can't buy new trucks.
And yeah, doesn't allow you to keep your ship running tightly.
No.
We spoke of the last mile business partnerships, Andy, and of course, I've been out of UPS now for 10 years, but before I left, we were starting to see that the Postal Service was, or UPS was making agreements with the Postal Service to deliver packages. I know it's happened with FedEx and probably Amazon too. Can you tell our listeners about that and how that's undermined your operation?
And, you know, and I'm not sure necessarily how much it's undermined the operation, but it's become more and more apparent that we are, there's a lot more commingling of UPS, FedEx, and UPS parcels.
Yeah, you know, well, UPS we don't parcels. Want them is because they're not profitable for us. So,
right. That, you know, if you're just delivering a single book out to a rural route, UPS or FedEx doesn't want to drive that, you know, that little $3 parcel out there. But the post office is heading that way anyhow, so the post office will take it. Now, we use those carriers to move our mail around too. So, you know, there's a give and take there. And of course, Amazon, the relationship between the Postal Service and Amazon got a lot of press. The president tweeted about it a number of times. He didn't have a very clear understanding of the relationship, but that didn't stop him from speaking on it. And so we've had this relationship with Amazon. Of course, they are driving to establish their own delivery networks through their through contractors and their own employees.
Yeah.
But they're rapidly jilting the post office, you know, as quickly as they can. But yeah,
they're not very efficient, Andy. I don't want to speak badly of them, but there are many as five or six of Amazon's trucks on my block every day.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
They're not consolidating their effort very well. In light of the under the hammer sort of situation you're in, do you expect any changes with the upcoming administration? Do we see any possibility that might improve under Joe Biden administration?
Well, you know, in the recent stimulus talks, the Postal Service has been included in several of those. I know in the CARES Act, there was pretty generous for the Postal Service, but in the recent stimulus talks, there is talk of providing some monies for the Postal Service. You know, frankly, we've lost around $9 billion each of the last 2 years. And of course, that's taking into account that $5.5 to $6 billion. So it's sort of a deceptive number, but it's still not a good number. Mm-hmm. Times are tough. The Postal Service ran into a lot of expenses with COVID. The Postal Service has had a lot of absenteeism with COVID. We've had a lot of people become infected or be quarantined. You know, I know over 100 postal workers have died since March. So it's been a serious thing in the workforce. But, you know, so the business model needs, it definitely needs some updating. And some of the things that the union has talked about, the letter carriers union, is to pursue postal banking, to be able to do licensing services at the post office, particularly in a smaller post office where you might otherwise have to go to the county seat in order to do those services. We would like to be able to ship beer and liquor and wine through the mail, which we can't currently do. Mm-hmm. So there's certainly some revenue streams that we would like to, that we would like to be sort of forward thinking about mm-hmm. with the Postal Service.
So can I say, not you, but can I say with an enlightened Postmaster General perhaps could kind of move it in a new direction, huh?
Well, you know, I think that Mr. DeJoy is probably going to be there for a while because he serves at the pleasure of the Postal Board of Governors, and there's currently support for him there. So mm-hmm. I think, you know, I think Mr. DeJoy will probably be around for at least the foreseeable future.
Mm-hmm. It was rumored, at least the news suggested, he had no experience whatsoever. Was that true or?
His background, he was a trucking guy. He grew a small trucking company into a trucking company of around 7,000 employees. He did a lot of work as a postal contractor, like his trucking company. You know, I mean, the Postal Service contracts out most of its shipping services, of its trucking. And so he was a postal contractor. And so he did business with the Postal Service, but, you know, he had no direct postal experience.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he was not a postal lifer like the last several postmaster general.
You know, most Americans can't envision this country without its postal service. But we're constantly hearing the bad omens of its demise. And what do you see as the future of the USPS?
Well, you know, I think that we've been around for 245 years. We've survived the telegraph and the telephone and the fax machine and email and the internet, all of which were supposed to be our demise. But here we are. We've performed great work through the pandemic. We've demonstrated our value to the public through the pandemic. We're still a company that employs around 640,000 people, about 100,000 veterans. We're in the fabric of every community. We are a part of our neighborhoods, and we share our lives with our customers. So, you know, we're a part of the infrastructure. Yeah. So I think that we should be treated as such.
Well, I would certainly say that America loves its mailmen and its mailwomen. I know that I love mine, man. My guy, 25 years on, I can set my clock by him, man. He's here every day at 12:30, come hell or high water. And, you know, so much so that I make sure he gets a little bonus every Christmas because he puts himself out for his customers. I know all of his family. I've watched them grow up. I know his dog's name. And he lives 40 miles away from here, man. But he's been that kind of a personal guy. And I would imagine that of the, you know, 300,000 Americans, half of them feel the same way as I do about my mailman. I love the guy, you know. So I can't see it going away. And I know I'd be out on the front line with them to encourage the continuation of that kind of service and dedication.
Well, we love you back.
So we certainly hope to see you around for a long, long time, Andy, because I don't see us doing it without you. And I think what you've proved over and over again, man, is the resilience of your workforce. You know, as you said, you've changed with all of these things that we're supposed to eliminate. And yet you're one of the strongest institutions, I feel, that we have in America, you know.
Well, we are the most trusted and most popular government agency, you know, and have been for years. Yeah. And, you know, we're the friendly face of government, and we relish that role.
Mm-hmm. Well, all I can say, Andy, is keep up the good work, and I'm sure most of our listeners feel the same way. And I would want to thank you for coming on the Heartland Labor Forum and joining with us to kind of share some of the trials and tribulations that have been going on and clear up some of the misinformation that has existed for sure. So thank you for joining us on the Heartland Labor Forum, and we wish you a very good night.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate being here. Hope I can come back.
Nothing lasts forever. At the heart of it, that is why KKFI is working with you to raise $40,000 in December of 2020. The Tire Backup Project is the next logical step in our work to ensure KKFI remains here for you, all day, every day. Much of our equipment has been in constant use since 1988, and as this year is proving over and over, You just never know what is going to happen. So we'll be prepared. You can help right now and get your donation doubled. A group of KKFI supporters will match the first $11,000 raised this December. So take the time to go to kkfi.org/donate and show your support. Thank you.
And here's the latest update. We've raised over $6,000, which has been doubled to $12,000, well on our way to our $40,000 goal. There is another $5,000 to be doubled. So make your gift right now at kkfi.org if you can. Thank you.
Good evening and welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum on 90.1 KKFI, Kansas City's community radio. I'm your host, Christine Dismang, and today we're going to talk to Nicole Bateman, who's a research analyst with the Metropolitan Policy Program at the Brookings Institution. Her work focuses on improving labor market outcomes for all workers, especially those our economy most often leaves out or leaves behind. In October 2020, Nicole Bateman co-wrote an article called "Why Has COVID-19 Been Especially Hard on Working Women?" Today, we are going to explore that exact question. Thank you for joining us today, Nicole.
Thank you so much for bringing me on.
Well, my very first question is, what started this article? Because it is a very specific topic, but it's actually rather fascinating. It caught my eye whenever I found it on the internet. But how did you decide to write this article?
Of course. So there are a lot of stories out there, particularly that have come out over the last several months about how women have been especially hard hit by the COVID-19 crisis. In the early months, they were more likely to become unemployed. And what we've been hearing about most recently is how they have been pushed out of the labor market as balancing work and children has become unsustainable. So my colleague Martha Ross and I decided to write this article highlighting the plight of women during this pandemic because, of course, we wanted to draw attention to the conditions that working women are facing right now. But we also really wanted to highlight how this crisis has merely amplified conditions women faced in the labor market long before the pandemic. And that's really one of our key messages here.
Well, I think it's an excellent article that you guys started. I saw that's kind of part of a series.
It is. It's part of the 19th Amendment series that the Brookings Institution put together in honor of the 100th anniversary of women's suffrage in the United States. So it really takes a look at a lot of different conditions that women are facing in the United States, including the economy. And that's where this piece came in.
And that's perfect because this year is the 100-year anniversary of women's suffrage in the United States, and women have gained so much within the past 100 years. However, we all know that there's still discrepancy in the workplace. Could you expand on some of them, some of the things that women are still experiencing today?
Absolutely. You hit on a lot of important points there. Before I dive into some of the inequities that women are facing in the workplace, I do just want to really drive home this point that you made about women gaining so much in the last 100 years. And I have two examples here that I can provide to demonstrate how women have become so essential to the economic well-being of households and families by entering the workplace. So the first example is that the increased income of women was responsible for nearly all of the increase in middle-class household incomes since 1979. So without women entering the workforce and receiving pay in exchange for their work, the income of families and households would have remained stagnant. Second, according to 2017 data, more than 40% of mothers are the breadwinner in their families. So families and households have become very dependent on the income that women are bringing in to their households. But despite all of this, to get to your second question about the inequities they're still facing, despite their changed role in the economy, they often face difficulties that are unique to their gender. And again, I have two examples here. First, even though women increasingly work outside of the home, they also remain the primary caregivers. So prior to the pandemic, women working full-time spent 50% more time each day caring for their families compared to men working full time. So even though they're out in the workforce, they're out in the workplace, they are still also being heavily relied on to care for children. Second, and we've heard a lot about this too, women are paid less per dollar than men, just about 80 cents to the dollar, a little bit more. Some of this difference is because of differences between men and women in education, occupation, industry, work experience, etc. But even after you control for all of these differences, all of these factors that could reasonably explain the difference, women are still paid less than men. I've seen estimates ranging from 92 cents to 98 cents to the dollar. And while that might not seem like a lot, if you compound it over a salary, over a year, over a career, that difference really adds up and can have meaningful consequences for these women.
And that's the thing, that we still see this today, that somehow, even though we've made a lot of like progress, there's still issues and discrepancies that women are facing in labor today. And of course, recently we have everything with COVID-19 and the coronavirus. And that has made, we cannot deny that, that has made such an impact on everybody in the world. But in your article, you discussed that women have been hit especially hard because of COVID-19. Could you explain why that is and how it also brought to light the divide that still exists in labor?
Yes. So I think you're absolutely right that this crisis has hit everyone. But I don't want to discount that women have been especially hard hit. So this economic crisis caused by the pandemic has been one of the most unequal in our history. So low-wage jobs have been hit especially hard during this pandemic. So while the highest earning jobs have actually recovered and gained since March, there's something like 20% fewer jobs in the low-wage labor market than there were earlier this year. And, you know, why is this consequential for women? It is, although it might not seem immediately obvious. And the reason it's consequential for women is because they make up a disproportionate share of those working in low-wage jobs. So 54% of low-wage workers are women, despite women making up only 47% of the workforce overall. So the layoffs that we saw, particularly at the beginning of the crisis, and again, the slower speed with which those jobs have recovered, has had more consequences for women because of their overrepresentation among this this workforce. So I think it's also important to note that workers in these low-wage jobs more often, live paycheck to paycheck, go without paid leave or healthcare benefits from their employers. And a job loss can be especially devastating, particularly in a time like right now when another is hard to come by. Putting aside the loss of jobs concentrated in the low-wage labor market, women are also being impacted for another major reason, and that is because prior to this crisis, their participation in the labor market more heavily relied on schools and childcare to facilitate their participation at the workplace. So according to an analysis I conducted of pre-pandemic data that is located in this article we're talking about today, nearly one in five working women relied on schools and childcare to provide supervision for their children while they were working prior to the pandemic. And this is compared to only one in eight men. So women were more overly reliant on these systems. And as a result of closures, of transitioning to remote learning, women, as a result, are reporting more job losses and reduced work hours because of childcare obligations. So while, again, these closures have affected everyone, women have been especially hard hit.
And that, it feels like that is an issue that you feel across, as a teacher myself, I have seen that with my fellow teachers and fellow women having issues either finding childcare, and I see that within my school as well, when it comes with the parents at home, who's going to be taking care of their child if they're online, hybrid, or in person, there is still that struggle that we're seeing. Have you happened to see any positive examples of assistance or policies that have been beneficial in the recent months, especially towards women?
Yes. So I would actually argue that the federal legislation passed early on in this crisis, namely the CARES Act and the Families First Coronavirus Response Act, while not perfect, of course, did a lot of good. So the evidence is very clear that the enhanced unemployment insurance provided and the economic impact payments prevented millions from falling into poverty and even reduced poverty rates. So those interventions were, you know, again, while not perfect, did a lot of good. We also do see examples of cities and states, of course, stepping in to fill gaps, although these are a little more consistent or inconsistent from place to place, of course. One example, here in DC where I am, there is a COVID-19 housing assistance program, and that program supports low-income renters who can't keep up with their payments because of an employment loss due to COVID. So these programs, the federal legislation, city and state interventions, while they are not specifically targeted to women, have improved or reduced the harm that they have experienced, as it has for all workers and families. Ultimately, though, states have balanced budget requirements, and supporting families and workers during this time takes a lot of money, and the federal government is needed to provide the kind of relief and support to people that meets the scale of this problem. And so ultimately, I think that there is a strong need for the federal government to intervene here.
And so what does that lead to? So there are some good things that are happening, but what are some next steps to happen to either lower these discrepancies or to make actual change?
Of course. In the immediate term, the federal government needs to re-up the supports it's offered workers and families through legislation like those policies passed in March. So the legislation in March did not anticipate that we would be breaking daily case records and experiencing new waves of temporary business closures to stem the virus, the spread of the virus in November, December. So most of the supports like expanded unemployment insurance, paid parental leave, and direct aid to states either have already expired soon, or were inadequate to meet the needs. So the federal government needs to step up and pass additional relief to prevent even more hardship, not only for working women, but all Americans. And they're in negotiations right now as we speak to do that, and we'll see what comes of it. But beyond this immediate term, which of course is important, we also need to think beyond the end of this crisis. If anything, this crisis has made even clearer the weaknesses and inequities in our economy. And we need to consider policies that become not only temporary, but permanent fixtures beyond the end of the pandemic that supports women in their chosen roles, whatever that may be, either as breadwinners in their family, mothers, or some combination of the two. And there are a lot of policy options here. So first, we could intervene to increase women's labor force participation. So ways that we could do that include incentivizing or funding predictable work scheduling, extending school day or before and after school programs, and offering paid parental leave. Those things could go a long way to close the difference between labor force participation rates between men and women. But we also really need to address the unequal and inadequate compensation for work performed by women. And policies that should be considered include an increased federal minimum wage, elimination of the tipped minimum wage, and policies that incentivize wage transparency at the firm level. So clearly there are a lot of options here. I don't think there will be any silver bullet, and it will take, you know, a combination of some of these or all of these, and we should explore those, and they should all be on the table moving forward.
I think you're absolutely correct. I feel like the coronavirus, COVID-19, what's happening now has exposed even more what's happening in our labor movement with women and with discrepancies, not just with women, but with race as well. I think maybe this is an opportunity for change moving forward, time to maybe clean the slate and change things as we move on forward. And so for our listeners that are still interested, where can they find the article or the series this article is part of, and where can they find more of your work?
Of course. So listeners can find more of this series at brookings.edu. If you search 19A, it will come up. I also do want to plug, I am part of the Metropolitan Policy Program at Brookings, and we do have a recovery index, and we're also tracking policies that are happening at the local level, and those can also be found at brookings.edu. There's a lot of good research resources there. People should go there and check them all out.
All right, well, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And everyone who's listening, that was Nicole Bateman talking about the impact of COVID-19 on working women. I'm your host, Christina Disming, and thank you for listening to the Heartland Labor Forum.
We have plowed and we have planted. We have gathered into bars, done the same work as the men, with babies in our arms. But you won't find our stories in most history books you read. We were there, we're still here, fighting for the things we need. We were there in the factories, we were there in the mills. We were there in the mines and came home to fix the meals. We were there on the picket line. We raised our voices loud. It makes me proud just knowing we were there. From the textile mills in Lawrence to the sweatshops in New York, from the fields in California, where our children had to work, we fought to make a living. Bread and roses was our pride. Though they jailed and beat our bodies, our spirits never died. We were there. African and Jew, Italian and Latina, Chinese and Russian too. They tried to use our differences to split us all apart, but the pain we felt together touched the bottom of our heart. We were there in the factories, we were there. We are teachers.
Good evening, Kansas City. This is Angie Williams with the Law Offices of Angela L. Williams with another edition of Know Your Rights. Today I thought I'd talk a little bit about the most recent lawsuit related to the elections, the one that was started by Texas that Missouri and Kansas joined to try to overturn the results of the presidential elections in four states, Georgia, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. I want to talk about this because this lawsuit's really unusual, and I think a lot of people don't necessarily understand how it worked or how it was decided. So in this case, Texas decided to apply directly to the Supreme Court, asking their permission to file a lawsuit related to the what they thought was irregularities in Georgia, Michigan, Pennsylvania. The reason they filed this lawsuit directly to the Supreme Court was because they were relying on a very specific, not very often used way that the Supreme Court can hear cases. And that's relying on the court's what's called original jurisdiction that involves interstate disputes. Now, most of the time, this is related to more mundane things like water rights or mineral rights or things like that. So it was very unusual that something this time sensitive and something this big they were using to try to get the Supreme Court to hear this. Now, the Supreme Court ultimately said no. We're not going to hear this. This isn't a thing. You can't do this. However, two justices, Thomas and Alito, said that without commenting on the merit of the case necessarily, that they thought that the Supreme Court could hear a case like this because it related to an interstate conflict. This was really a last Hail Mary attempt by people who believe the current president that the election was quote-unquote stolen. Now, this is after more than 50 lawsuits had been already thrown out in the lower courts. The rest of the justices, except for Alito and Thomas, just outright said, no, you can't file this type of action. And they based that decision on something called standing. This is a very specific legal term, and standing means people that have the right to sue and people who have the right to intervene in other people's lawsuits. A lot of cases in the legal realm are dismissed for lack of standing, meaning that the person filing the lawsuit or asking for the relief doesn't have the right to ask for that type of relief. A lot of times this has to do, like in this case, with other people's or entities' rights. In this case, they said there was no standing for Texas to challenge, and all the rest of the states, Texas and all of them to challenge the voting procedures of other people's states. Now, if you think about this decision about lack of standing, which is how the majority decided this, it really makes a lot of sense. Standing means that you have to have an interest, a protected interest in someone else's stuff, for lack of a better word. It means that something that a lawsuit is going to decide for person A has to directly affect person B to allow them to intercede. The example that I gave about the water rights is a perfect example of how two states can have an interest in each other, but it has to be a very specific thing. For example, with water rights, let's say there's water that straddles both Missouri and Kansas, and Missouri is using that water and accessing that water in a way that, let's say, Kansas doesn't like. They might have a real dispute between the two people. Now, you can't really say that for Georgia, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin's electoral votes and election procedures. Texas has its own rules, Missouri has its own rules, Kansas has its own rules, and they're all different from each other. Allowing a state like Texas or Missouri and Kansas to tell another state that they are voting wrong, or voting in a way that they don't like, opens the door to a huge arena of states trying to tell other states what to do. This, in this case, is being pushed by a conservative side. But what if, let's say, a more liberal state like California doesn't appreciate the way that Missouri handles a controversial issue like, for example, abortion? This type, granting the permission to file this type of lawsuit might actually open the door to those types of challenges, and that's not something that we want. In any case, I wanted to talk a little bit about that because there's a lot of confusion. But that's all the time we have. This is another edition of Know Your Rights with Angela Williams from the Law Offices of Angela L. Williams. Please be safe, wear a mask, social distance, wash your hands, and happy holidays.
At the end of the segment before Know Your Rights was Bev Grant's We Were There. Our calendar can be found on our Facebook page at the Heartland Labor Forum Facebook page. Saturday, December 19th, 9 a.m., Wyandotte County, Third Saturday Democratic Meeting Without the Breakfast. Too bad. Speakers are Thomas Witt, Executive Director of Equality Kansas, and Topeka Attorney Rich Benson, who will discuss the election results in Kansas. And to get the link, you'll have to go to our Facebook page and find it there. All Souls UU Forum, Reforming Police, Government, Health, and Education Systems with Sheila Elbers, whose son, John, was shot 13 times by a cop in front of their home in Johnson County. That's Sunday, December 20th at 10 a.m. And again, there's a link which you can find on our calendar. And then tell any K through 12 student you know that there's community haircuts free and some free hot meals and new or slightly used shoes, coats, and clothing. The barbers are licensed. This is Sunday from this coming Sunday from 12 to 6 p.m. at 221 North 18th Street in Kansas City, Kansas. This is sponsored by the Jegna Club, and they'll be giving these haircuts to the first 150 people who arrive. That's it for tonight's show. Tune in next week. Our show is The Truth About Santa's Workshop. The Heartland Labor Forum is a member of the Labor Radio Podcast Network. Check out the rich diversity of programming related to workers and unions at laborradionetwork.org. Thanks to tonight's engineer, Jen Zaman. Listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, a show by and about workers, our workplaces, and our labor movement. We are radio that talks back to the boss, and you can talk back too. Send us your workplace stories, news, and ideas for shows to heartlandlaborforumkkfi@gmail.com. Our website, where we archive shows and post our upcoming schedule, is heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here at 90.1 FM KKFI.